Elevate every morning with Tommy John's Second Skin underwear. The luxurious support of Second Skin guarantees everything will go smoothly. With over 20 million pairs sold and thousands of five-star reviews, guys love Tommy John. Plus, your most valuable assets are covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear or its free guarantee. Get 20% off your first order at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. Save 20% at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. See site for details.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Spectrum Business works with small businesses nationwide, so we know that running your own business means doing it all. Marketing, sales, inventory, customer service, and more. Spectrum One for Business helps you keep it all connected for just $49.99 a month. Get fast, reliable internet, advanced Wi-Fi with security shield, and a free mobile line for one low price. Stay connected and do it all with Spectrum One for Business. Only $49.99 a month. Go to spectrum.com/business to learn more. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to World Affairs, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Dr. Margot Tudor, a postdoctoral research fellow at the University of Exeter. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. Henry Redwood about his new book, The Archival Politics of International Courts, published by Cambridge University Press in 2021. Henry is a lecturer in international relations at London South Bank University. So Henry, welcome to the interview.
Hiya.
I wonder if we could just begin by you telling us a little bit about yourself, where you grew up, how you became an academic, anything about how you were inspired to write the book.
Okay, as you said, I'm a lecturer in international relations at London South Bank, but I guess my academic background isn't really from a traditional IR. I didn't take a traditional IR route into these things. I did a history undergrad and MA at University of Bristol, and it was really there that my interest in the topic of archives and international courts took root. I took a module about the memory of genocide, focusing specifically on the Holocaust, the third year module. I just became really interested by this question of the types of stories that courts tell us and the roles that these stories play in shaping collective memories of past violence. But as I think is, I guess, the central theme in the book, how these end up shaping also understandings of communities, past, present and future. And so that was I did my undergraduate dissertation and MA dissertations thinking about these questions, but I became, I guess, increasingly dissatisfied with the overt focus of that, from within the discipline of history, on the Holocaust and the post-World War II Holocaust trials. And so I increasingly became more interested in Rwanda as something that I think has had an interesting lack of focus across all disciplines, really, given what has happened. And then I ended up visiting Rwanda and became increasingly more involved and interested in Rwanda today as well. And through that pathway led me to do a PhD, which is the basis. My PhD thesis is the basis of the book, although morphed considerably in the years since I finished that PhD. But yeah, that's really the trajectory that I took to get to where I am now. And so I did my PhD at King's College London in the War Studies department, which is, I guess, an explicitly hybrid interdisciplinary space. So whilst I went in as a historian, there I worked with international lawyers and international relations experts. And just over time found, I think, that the types of conversations that I was speaking to, whilst always interdisciplinary, were more rooted in some of the IR literature, which saw me migrate more and more in that direction through a series of postdocs and lectureships to where I am now, which is an IR lecturer at London South Bank University.
That's, yeah, I mean, shout out to Tim Cole. Because I think I ended up taking that module too. And I completely agree. Amazing. You have that kind of Nuremberg, yeah, I know, Bristol alumni, we are everywhere. Yeah. it's so fascinating to hear about how that really inspired you so early on, and then kind of taking that through and really working to think about how your dissertations could reframe the whole kind of way we think about international criminal courts and law and memory. Because yeah, I agree with you. I think often there is that focus on or the shadow of Nuremberg in a lot of this scholarship. And so I suppose once with this wonderful book, you kind of reflect more on the silences in those archives as much as the contents of them. And you refer to those voices that are excluded or experiences that have been erased. And so how do you think that erasure effect in international criminal courts actually is kind of a reflection of power? And how are those societal hierarchies reproduced in those in the archival process? What is that role of the archives?
That's such a good question, and one that would probably take a day to unpack with any adequacy. I mean, I think I'll say two things in response to that. One is silences are fundamentally important to the archive and reflect, I guess, the limits of the archivals and the archive's imagination and the archivist's imagination. But I mean, this emphasis on silence is something that has been like really hammered home in transitional justice literatures and also some of the more historically situated readings of the Holocaust trials, people like Lawrence Douglas from the history side of things. And I think that what silence is important, restrictions are important, what isn't recorded in the archive is really important. And I do address all of those things in the book. But I think we can only learn so much from the power and politics of the archive by just thinking about what's excluded. And that was, I guess, one of my main criticisms of lots of the transitional justice literature, which is that it continually re-emphasizes almost a truism that courts can't tell adequate stories of mass atrocity. And I think there is definitely issues with the way that courts tell their stories. But actually, if all we do is focus on exclusions, I think we miss understanding what's the huge amount of data and information that's within these archives. But also, we only get a partial insight into why that knowledge and information exists as it does. So if we want to answer your second question, really, which is how does this link to power relations within society, I think we have to understand this interrelationship between inclusion and exclusion rather than just focus on what's not there. I mean, yeah, that said, I think especially in chapter 6, when I do look at these questions of more explicitly of what type of community is produced, I think what becomes very apparent is whilst ultimately this is unsurprisingly given the era in which the court functioned, a site that reproduces a liberal understanding of community, that what's interesting is what is going on underneath these liberal claims. And that's exactly when we see these often violent orderings of society in relation to the international, the local, the exclusion of gender-based violence, the exclusion of the subaltern. All of these things end up producing, I guess, a much more worrying understanding of knowledge within the archive, but also then what types of communities are produced through these archives. And that's the fundamental thread through the book, is thinking about this interrelationship between law, knowledge, governance and community, and thinking about how that plays out and produces particular social orderings.
Yeah, I mean, those threads are really, really key to the book. And it's really clear how, yeah, that inclusion, the aspect that inclusion of what we can tell from courts are as interesting as those exclusions as well. And yeah, it's sometimes in the literature very, very clear to see that there is that dominant perspective that excludes sometimes or sidelines what the court archives can actually tell us. And I suppose going back to what you were saying earlier about the choice of case study, or your choice of your primary case study being the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, or ICTR, and obviously the wealth of documentary and testimonial evidence that was produced in that trial. I think that relates to your point you just made. And so I suppose, why did you choose the ICTR? What was it that drew it to you? I mean, you mentioned briefly earlier that you'd visited, but what was it specifically about the ICTR's archival processes that inspired you?
I think it was initially probably a little bit pragmatic, if I'm honest, which was, you know, we constantly are looking, as at that time, I guess I was a historian, for something new and a new site. And it was, I think there's a politics to the neglect of the ICTR and Rwanda, which is reflective more generally of relationships between global North and South. And if you compare to what's being written about the ICTY, the equivalent court for the former Yugoslavia, and the Yugoslav wars more generally, there's a wealth of information and work that's been done that hasn't been reflected in Rwanda. So I started off a bit pragmatically, but then realizing this imbalance, I guess, became a bit more political, and then the decision, and then becoming more, personally invested in Rwanda as a place, as an amazing place with amazing people. That was sort of cemented the focus, I guess, picking the ICTR over other possibilities. And also, I think there was, again, practically, also about what types of arguments you can make. I often thought maybe I should have been writing about the ICC, but I think there's something about the ICTR in the position that it occupies in the evolution of international criminal justice at this, I think, defining moment of thinking or rethinking what an international community might look like after the end of the Cold War. And that when I was writing and studying it, it basically almost come to a close. That it just provided, I think, a really rich research site as well to begin to be asking these questions about the interrelationship between law, knowledge and community.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, I suppose the 1990s is such an evocative moment for shifts within international criminal justice that it definitely speaks to a really important case study for thinking about almost those preliminary ideas or the formulation of a lot of those ideas that then led up to the creation of the ICC in this particularly kind of important moment or significant moment for international order, international criminal justice. And I suppose in chapter four, you kind of discuss that a little bit more in the sense that you talk about the indictment processes specifically and how those shaped the record keeping systems of the trial. And I suppose I'm quite interested in those granular processes of actually specifically like what the types of legal documentary evidence that was preserved. And I suppose, could you just take us through how the ICTR's indictments had this impact on court procedures and how it was preserved within the archive and what that did?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the indictments, for those that aren't familiar to courts and how they operate, and again, to say I'm no legal expert, right? I've spent a lot of time reading about law, but I'm not a lawyer. And I think that actually that perspective of coming at law without a legal background makes law seem really weird in lots of respects that I think is often concealed to lawyers who accept just the way it works as almost with it beyond questioning, which is on a tangent is, I think, fundamentally more of that's an issue to do with why law can never quite adequately reform itself, I think. So the indictment is the instrument that charges defendants against the crimes contained within the court's statute. So in essence, when we're thinking about what stories are told and how they're limited, it's arguably along with the statute, although because the statute influences the indictment, you could say that the indictment's the most important, shapes the stories that these trials will tell, because ultimately this sets out ahead of the trial what narratives the prosecution are gonna tell throughout their case. And because of the way that the legal systems works in these contexts, that also means that the defense is limited in effect to responding to that indictment. So the indictment framework is really the main storytelling framework that underpins every trial at the ICTR and continues to act in that way at the ICC. And I guess the indictments, you could tell the story of the ICTR and you could tell the story that I tell in the book through the indictments in lots of respects. So one of the things that I look at is how imaginings of justice and as a consequence community shifts over time. So what we see is this evolution from a relatively broad, holistic, you might call it a sort of weak restorative vision of justice in the early trials, to a very narrow legalistic understanding of the role of justice and the function of justice, a form of sort of a traditional form of retributive justice by the end of the ICTR's existence. And what does that mean for the indictments? Well, when we look at the early indictments, we see incredibly broad ranging charges. We see this real emphasis on trying to tell a holistic account of the genocide and what happened in Rwanda. So this is both geographically covering the violence that occurs across Rwanda at different times, covering different people. So we see musicians indicted, we see prime ministers indicted, we see generals, clergymen, local businessmen. There's this really, this is real emphasis on, I think, telling this holistic, deep truth within the indictments. But they're also constructed in a way where witnesses end up playing a much more integral role in shaping of the trials, which is something we can maybe talk about later. But what we see as the indictment, as indictment practices goes on, particularly after the UN tells the court to close down in 2003, is the shift towards these incredibly focused, narrow, narrow indictments that have far fewer crimes contained within them, far more specific in lots of respects, which has knock-on consequences for the witnesses. But we really see that by the end of the ICTR's existence, and this that plays out statistically as well, we see a statistical decline in the number of charges lodged in indictments. But by the end of the ICTR, we see this basically almost sole focus on efficiency and judgment outputs as the metrics of success. So we see this shift in the indictments from very broad, holistic, almost restorative emphasis of the indictments to this really narrow, much narrower vision of justice and the tribunal.
Yeah, and I suppose as part a key part of that storytelling process or the indictment process is this idea of constructing actors, which is obviously a big part of the middle of your book and thinking about those different binaries of kind of perpetrator versus victim and having those formed within the court archives through these documents like indictments, as you've talked about. And, you know, when we think about the kinds of different arguments and characteristics that were reinforced in this process, how do you think the archive kind of legitimized these arguments or these binaries for the record in as part of the, quote, official history?
I'm not sure I fully understand the point about how it legitimizes. I mean, so maybe we can take that separately after. But so when we look at how these core archives function, you're 100% right that they construct this sort of Manichean vision of the world where we have the good and the bad, we have the perpetrators and we have the victims, and we see very particular understandings of who are perpetrators and victims. And so I think that's one of the things that, in essence, everything's political, right? All knowledge is political. And that's, I open with a quote from Foucault in that respect, that about the relationship between knowledge and power. So even something that we take to be such an inherent given, that perpetrators are bad and victims are good, when we look at the what sort of power and knowledge and politics underpins that, we get some really interesting things in the court records. So with the perpetrators, the active sort of the active figures within the genocide, the victims are these passive, innocent figures, but that also becomes both incredibly gendered and framed within the court's very limited understanding of the genocide as an ethnic crime. So in essence, we get, in that respect, we get this limited understanding of victims as being feminine subjects. So predominantly women, children, and the elderly. And these are emphasized as subjectivities to sort of prove the case that we're talking about meaningful victims and not potential perpetrators. And over time, for lots of different reasons, but the ICTR ends up presenting this sort of incredibly neat and very problematic binary of perpetrators equals Hutus and Tutsis equals victims. To the point where we have a couple of moments where, which I cite in the book, where in essence, the naming of a victim as a Tutsi is enough to evidence genocide, or at least genocidal intent. And when we look at why the genocide actually took place and the what underpinned it, yes, the Tutsis were the majority of the victims of the violence, but it was fundamentally a political act, and one of the greatest, one of the biggest symbols of that is who was killed first. It was the Hutus that were opposed to Hutu power and the genocide plan. And so I think that it produces this very blunt, stunted understanding of violence, which can have really significant knock-on effects later on. And this is not something that's just a problem with courts. It's a problem with transitional justices' imaginings of perpetrator and victimhood more generally. But this has really significant consequences. It's perhaps if we think that women are passive agents and victims of violence, it's unsurprising they're not often included in peace negotiations. When we reproduce these really entrenched notions of victimhood, I mean, what is a sort of something that unifies almost all acts of genocide are claims to universal victimhoods, right? And so this reproduction of inherent victims versus inherent perpetrators, I think, is fundamentally the antithesis of any form of meaningful reconciliation, and has, I think, long-term, potentially really significant consequences.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Is there such a thing as a traveler? Not a Delta. Because we know on one flight, Mike in 8C prefers reality TV to reality. So we provide more than 1,000 hours of in-flight entertainment. While on the flight after, 8C is occupied by Jen, whose favorite snack is tea. That's why we provide fast, free Delta Sync Wi-Fi available for SkyMiles members. Because at Delta, we know. Refill? Everyone flies their own way. Delta. Keep climbing. Free Wi-Fi available on most domestic flights. Terms of use apply.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Yeah, definitely. I think that the idea that you're reproducing and entrenching that ethnic separatism through the court's kind of ideas, I think, yeah, that you can see clearly. I mean, we also understand that having or building a state on an idea or a nation on the idea of victimhood is inherently very, very politically dangerous. And so kind of having this book as a part of that conversation to kind of actually criticize that approach and try and examine what are those processes that actually allow for this dominant binary approach to perpetuate those ideas post-conflict is really important, because I think sometimes it is just, oh, well, those were the that was the established narrative during the conflict, and therefore we're just working off of what was established in the conflict, you know, that it's a historical fact. Whereas actually what your work is doing is actually showing how that was a constructed process through these transitional justice spaces, these international spaces, as much as it was within the kind of national narratives from the RPF afterwards, obviously. And you were mentioning earlier about your section on witnesses, and I thought that was a really fascinating aspect about their kind of active participation in this constructive process, you know, contesting the idea that witnesses were passive or can be passive, I suppose, in aligning with your idea about this, the gendered aspect of victimhood, but also trying to think about which other groups are marginalized within court spaces. And indeed, you kind of describe them more as co-constructors rather than as just witnesses that are passive to the entire court process. And so could you just expand a bit on why you wanted to include an entire section on witnesses and what their role was really in shaping the ICTR?
Yeah, well, I think it's about a response. Like as I said, I came to this from partially being a historian, but also then becoming more interested in transitional justice stuff, and just finding that there'd been in both camps this near complete acceptance of courts tell bad stories. I mean, with some exceptions like Nigel Eltringham and Lawrence Douglas and Charles Meyer, like there are exceptions to that, but this understanding that these tell bad stories is an implicit part of both sets of literatures, even though they're really poorly and weirdly unconnected to each other. And within that, there's this assumption that means as well, or a symptom of this, is that witnesses are, courts are these sites of silence. Witnesses come and they tell these incredibly stunted, legalistic accounts of violence, and they basically walk into the courtroom, tell what they're forced to tell, and then leave. And they are these passive actors throughout this whole process, and that to me just always didn't ring true. It felt too absolute, especially when we think about historical precedents like the Eichmann trials. But also when I started reading the transcripts from the three trials that I looked at, I zeroed in on three particular trials. When I looked at the first trial of Jean-Paul Lachiesu, it was just really clear that this understanding of witnesses as these passive actors in courts just didn't map onto what I was seeing. And that's actually not to say that other scholars are wrong. They were also looking at different courts, right? And they were looking at lots of this isn't being done in relation to the ICTY or the Special Court of Sierra Leone. So I think there's also a case that these things can be different in different, these power dynamics can be different in different places. But when we look at the ICTR, I think you see the witnesses play this really substantial role in shaping, in the early trials, that is, play this role in shaping the nature of the trials themselves. Again, that's why I use the word co-constructed. It's not unlimited. It's still constrained by the statute, by the prosecution's interests, by the rules of the court. But especially in these early trials, those rules are pretty fluid and ever-changing. And so we see the witnesses, I guess, able to get a greater stranglehold on the trial to push it in different directions. But again, much like we see with indictment practice, we see this power and ability of the witnesses to influence these types of stories that tell diminish with time. And ultimately, much like the sort of reductive vision of trials as just pumping out outputs, we end up with a much more and increasingly utilitarian vision of the witness at the ICTR. And I think that trajectory is important both for understanding the ICTR, but also because I think that this is something that we've continued to see at the ICC as well. So yeah, I think that it was because it's an important part of the story, but also to try and add a bit of nuance or a different perspective on what I thought witnesses actually do in these sites in comparison to what lots of the literature is saying on this.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that idea that I think your book does add that nuance in the sense of there is more fluidity to power in these spaces than perhaps those fixed roles that a lot of critical work that has done before has kind of gone the opposite direction, in the sense of, oh, okay, so then there's absolutely no agency from any witnesses or from even victims who are trying to participate within the court system, rather than seeing it as this kind of space where there's limited room to maneuver. Of course, there are those constraints, but actually trying to amplify it and shed light on those spaces, those limited spaces where agency and voice was allowed or kind of amplified within that space. And I suppose that fluidity is interesting for when you talk a little bit later on about how justice and ideas of justice shift throughout that tribunal process. You know, changing from the initial identified idea of what justice might be at the beginning, or how it was promoted at the beginning, and then how once through the procedure it evolves. And I was just interested in how you think those ideas of justice change and what kind of processes or voices affect the evolution of that concept.
Yeah, so I guess that's this builds on the last, well, two of the points that we've already been discussing, which is the shift in emphasis on or role of indictments, and also the shifting role of the witnesses. And so what we see, as you say, is this like a shift towards a much more broad-based, holistic understanding of justice, a weak form of restorative justice, is much more narrower understanding of retributive justice. And I think that, well, in the book, I argue that there are two to three main factors that influence that shift. The first is a settling of the law, in essence. And so if we, lots of the criticism, I think, of the ICTR and the ICTY forgets what sort of an insane undertaking it was. Like, these were the first international courts that have been created since Nuremberg, the first meaningful international courts in the sense that Nuremberg was a tribunal made up of the victors of World War II. So whilst international, it was also very limited in terms of who was doing the prosecuting. So these were international courts applying a body of law that had been almost dormant, for except for in scholarly work, for 40 years. And that's a huge undertaking, right? And I think we should temper the criticism of these courts with that sort of acknowledgement. But so what that means, in essence, when we're thinking about how the court functioned in the early years, is that they were making sort of lots of it up as they were going along, which I think created this elasticity around what the court process was, what the sort of the legal rules were in terms of both substance but also procedure. And that went hand in hand with opening up space where witnesses could play more of a role, where more expansive visions of justice could take place. I think that's also mirrors the age that we're talking about, right? Which is the post-Cold War world, and this hope that we could have for the first time a meaningful form of international community underpinned by sort of a liberal cosmopolitanism. And I think that, you know, this is the era of the Truth Commission, and I think importantly the first prosecutor for the ICTR and ICTY was Richard Goldstone, who had been fundamental to the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and I think imported lots of this thinking into the courts. So I think the very way that these courts functioned early on meant that the legal rules were such that they were flexible and were being not manipulated in as in a victor's justice or show trial way, but flexible so that they could bend around the violence that they were addressing and take into consideration these broader sort of transitional justice claims and needs. But over time, that obvious novelty wears off, and what the rules are, what the law is, I think becomes increasingly stabilized through the sort of repetitive citation of the law as it is. And we see this both substantively, so legal rulings on what constitutes different parts of the statutes becomes more regulated and more fixed, but also procedurally. So the way that indictment needs to be submitted, what needs to be contained in it, becomes much more formalized and predictable, and that has a knock-on effect in terms of how power is distributed within the court. So essentially away from witnesses, more towards legal actors. And then the second main force behind this is, I guess, the external political force and the tribunal's relationship to other UN organs, particularly the Security Council. And so in essence, in the early 2000s, well, really beginning in the late 90s, Security Council is becoming increasingly annoyed by the ICTR and ICTY. They're seen as costly, ineffective, they're not really doing very much. And so they're both courts are told to close down as quickly as possible, and both courts are told to create a completion strategy, which is finalised at the ICTR in 2003. And this basically just means that the whole sort of modus operandi of the ICTR becomes about shifting their cases as quickly as possible. And that with that naturally comes, I think, a dropping off of the other interests. All actors, I think, except for the defence, I would argue, which is something I didn't really have space to elaborate on in the book, sort of get on board with this efficiency drive. And we just see that that becomes the way in which success is measured. And we can see this in later reports that are submitted from the ICTR to the UN Security Council, which sort of use these graphs and statistics to emphasise that they're cutting down the length of trials, they're being quicker, they're being more efficient, and also in judicial rulings. So we have rulings which say you need to reduce your number of witnesses, we don't have the money or the time to be hearing witnesses needlessly. And so we see this focus on justice comes at a cost, and I would say that cost is the court's previous interest in broader themes of and broad interpretations of justice, mainly around the role and position of witnesses and ideas of reconciliation, and also around the types of stories that these courts can tell.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it leads really well into that idea that the overwhelming bureaucracy or kind of realism of pursuing a court, as you were saying earlier on, is how can the law reform itself, or how can legal practitioners seek reform within an institution that has such strict boundaries on how practice works, how courts work, and how systems are established, and for the kind of very utilitarian purposes you mentioned earlier. And I suppose just kind of thinking about how that then shifts into your thinking about chapter six, thinking a little bit more about the illiberal undercurrents concealed within that liberal vision of community. It was such a fascinating chapter for me. I thought it was really interesting about how, thinking about how broadly actually that application is, you know, that kind of illiberal kind of toxicity that is concealed within liberal visions, just broadly within the international order, and then obviously within the court archives themselves. And I was just wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about the function of the International Archive in kind of perpetuating this particular liberal ideal, whilst also kind of simultaneously constructing illiberal forms of community.
Yeah, I think you're really right in saying that. I don't think that this is anything unique to the ICTR, and I would hazard that most, I know that the work that you do is on humanitarian interventions, or some of the work that you do is on humanitarian interventions. And I mean, that's lots of these logics, illiberal logics, are at the fundamental heart of understandings of humanitarian intervention more broadly. So I guess it's in essence, like, what that chapter does is think through, okay, so it's almost a truism that the archive is underpinned by liberal thinking and liberal ideas. It's a court of law for starters, and it was produced at a time where that faith and optimism in a liberal worldview was like rampant, if you like, within the international community. But when we look at the principle, and so with that comes different principles, so around responsibility, around equality and neutrality, around universalism, around all of these things that are central to a liberal worldview, that should be at the heart of these trials as well. But when we dig down into how they then actually operate in practice, we see these more concerning orderings and relationships between this liberal worldview and the types of incredibly illiberal community that are being constructed. So whether or not that's the way that the emphasis on responsibility ends up concealing the role of international actors in the genocide in Rwanda, producing this sort of dichotomy between the international as the saviour and the local as the site of barbarism, which is a narrative that helped the international community elide any responsibility for the genocide as it was taking place and never take adequate responsibility for what it did during the genocide to facilitate it. But more broadly, what we see is this, I guess it's not, in many respects, this is also not surprising. I think some lawyers would argue that this is almost a truism again, which is that these courts of law aren't about eradicating violence from the international domain. They're about attributing responsibility in very particular ways that limit and curtail violence without saying that violence per se is bad. And the reason that this is a truism is because this is, in essence, humanitarian law is the law of the military, law of militaries, which is something that Lewis Arbour, one of the ICR prosecutors, makes very clear. And so we have this, I guess, we see these as sites of progress about perpetuating or creating conditions of peace within the international community. But actually, when we look at what they do, they're about saying, yes, some forms of violence are bad, but in the process saying other forms of violence are legitimate. And then similarly, when we think about the notions of equality and neutrality, what we end up seeing as the trials play out is this incredibly gendered understanding of violence, of actors, of witnesses, that means that despite, so one of the tribunal's great success stories, according to them and their advocates, is its development of gender progressive jurisprudence. But when we look at what goes on underneath that, we see an incredibly worrying way in which systematically throughout the course of the tribunal, these crimes are being ignored, right? So there's not a neutral worldview. It's not a neutral capturing of the data. It reflects the patriarchal world that we live in, and that's mirrored in what knowledge is produced and what data is collected and what judgments are rendered. So this isn't also just about what stories are told, but it's about how different witnesses' credibility is understood and interpreted. And I think what's important then is that this production of the world, of particular world views, becomes reinforcing. So it's the world, these world views exist prior to the prosecutions themselves, but through the prosecutions they're made real, right? And when we think about what courts are supposed to be doing, prosecuting people for crimes that are committed, these have real, very overt and clear real world effects. And similarly, when we think about these courts' claims to universalism, when we look under the surface, it's a particular worldview that's continually propagated to the exclusion of other ways of interpreting the world that we live in and violence. And so that bit of the chapter looks at how, despite paying lip service to being sort of malleable and addressing the cultural specificity of Rwanda, that frequently Rwanda ways of knowing, which may be specific to Rwanda, but opposed to the way that the courts see how knowledge is produced, continually sidelined and ignored. And when I went my last visit to the archive in 2019, I think it was, I found this booklet which was that was given to witnesses prior to testifying, that basically tells them how to behave and what to say and what to do. And also there was this really interesting sort of emotional blackmail of witnesses as well, saying basically if you don't do it, no one else will, and without you, like, we'll never see peace. And it just, that book, I think, said everything about how the power relations between the ICTR and Rwanda evolved with time, and this sort of sense that the tribunal knows best and Rwandans don't, and with that an implicit forwarding of a Western Enlightenment logic and worldview to the detriment of post-colonial subaltern ways of knowing and acting.
God, that booklet sounds fascinating. And that definitely some explicit emotional blackmail going on there. I suppose it's also slightly terrifying in the sense of trying to put a responsibility on a witness in order to kind of go through obviously quite a traumatic process, but then also having that responsibility of, well, if you feel afterwards that you know, if you've been unable to kind of confine or make your testimony fit what we want it to be or what we kind of hope it will be, then you will therefore be responsible for not any further violence. That's what a terrifying finding in the archive. But
it says refusing to testify amounts to showing disregard for the law and for your country. Examine your conscience to find the answer. Ask yourself this: what good would it really do to have the events of Rwanda happen again? No one but you has the answer to the restoration of trust among Rwandan people. I mean, it's just, I just remember reading that if something captures the ICTR by its end, I feel that that's a bit symbolic of it. Yeah,
definitely. Yeah, that kind of very, very powerful idea of what the court was there to do. That's really compelling. Well, we're almost out of time, but we have time for one more question. So what are you working on now?
After I finished, so this was, as we've established, a book in a long time in the making. I started it in my third year of university, and it only came out in 2021. I don't want to do the maths to work out just how long that is in the making. Since I finished the PhD in the book, I've sort of migrated towards thinking about alternative models and mechanisms and ways of thinking about post-conflict intervention. So whereas the ICTR is this sort of very international, elite, top-down, heavy way of thinking about post-conflict justice and transition, I've started doing a lot more work with artists and civil society actors to think about how different ways of approaching storytelling and the past can open up different visions of peace. So I worked on a really amazing large AHRC project called Art and Reconciliation, which looked at the relationship between art and reconciliation in the Western Balkans. And since then, I've had a separate project which looked at participatory filmmaking with Bosnian youth activists in Bosnia. And through that, the nexus between the arts and civil society and alternative visions of peace is something that I'm exploring as one sort of core strand of my research. And then the other thing that I've been increasingly interested in and want to submit a grant application for, so that the arts and peace building stuff is stuff that's ongoing, and I've got publications coming out with the Journal of Peace Building and Development and a couple of edited volumes. I've also been doing work on Afghanistan of official war artists in Afghanistan, which is in critical studies on security, and then that's the arts side of things. And then I want to ask very similar questions to what I asked of the ICTR's archive about the British Records Office, which was created, I think it's 1816s, around that time. These archives, as other people like Pierre Nora have argued, are really central to nation building. And that's a key premise of the ICTR book as well. But I want to think about what types of nation building we can see within these types of archives, and thinking more explicitly about how these tie with colonial archives abroad, and how knowledge is exchanged between them. So I just found it's just the census from 1863. And it's just already the way that knowledge is produced from the center about the periphery, I think is just, is really interesting in tying images of the colonies to understandings of Britain at this key moment of modern nation building, which is happening across Europe at this time. I think there's a lot of interesting questions to ask of that time and of that type of archive. So yeah, two interconnected strands.
They both sound fascinating. Yeah, I think I don't know if you've been in touch with any of the people in the Humanitarian and Conflict Response Institute at Manchester, just about the arts project, because if not, I will put you in touch with some colleagues there who do very similar work.
Me and my friend Hannah went to speak there a couple of years ago about our work on Mark Neville. Roisin Reid.
Someone
that we've met at conferences and things, who's lovely.
Yeah, she was one of my PhD
work.
Supervisors.
Oh, she was. Oh, she's great. She's really, really, really cool. Does really great work. Yeah.
Oh, it's fantastic. Well, thank you so much for talking with me today. I learned so much from your book and I really, really enjoyed it. And I'm very much looking forward to seeing your future publications.
Thanks very much.